Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Bugsy's Shadow, Moe Sedway, Bugsy Siegel, and the Birth of Organized Crime in Las Vegas, by Larry D. Gragg. Narrated by Steve Menash. Preface. Since 2003, I have been researching and writing about the history of Las Vegas. I have explored the campaigns to promote the town, the struggle in the 1920s and 1930s to build a resort hotel, the efforts of women and African Americans to fully participate in the life of the community, the development of Las Vegas as America's entertainment capital, the perceptions of Las Vegas in popular culture, and the 1950s as the pivotal decade in the emergence of Las Vegas as a premier tourist destination. As I read the secondary and primary sources about Las Vegas in the 1940s, no matter what subject I was exploring, one name often dominated the discussion. New York mobster Benjamin Bugsy Siegel seemed a larger-than-life figure. To some, Siegel was the visionary founder of the famed Las Vegas Strip. To others, he was a profane, vicious thug who stole the idea of the fabulous Flamingo Hotel from another man. Regardless of how contemporaries and historians view him, Bugsy was a critical figure in the development of Las Vegas, and I had to investigate his history if I was to understand the community in the mid-20th century. I first dealt with him in a chapter in my book, Bright Light City, Las Vegas in Popular Culture, 2013, in two articles in the popular history magazine, History Today, and finally in Benjamin Bugsy Siegel, The Gangster, The Flamingo, and the Making of Modern Las Vegas, 2015. As I researched Siegel's New York background and his time in Las Vegas, another man kept appearing in the sources. However, like most other authors and commentators, I did not pay much attention to Morris Moe Sedway. He seemed at best a minor figure in the Siegel saga. Indeed, in some accounts, Moe was simply Bugsy's gopher, if he appeared at all. Yet in reviewing the text of the hearing of Estes Kefauver's Special Committee on Organized Crime and Interstate Commerce in Las Vegas on November 15, 1950, I discovered that Moe Sedway attracted the most attention among the eight witnesses that included William Moore, Lieutenant Governor Cliff Jones, Lewis Wiener Jr., Henry Phillips, Wilbur Clark, Lorenz Greeson, and Robert Kaltenborn. Not long after, I found an article that journalist Amy Wallace had published about Sedway and his wife Beatrice in the Los Angeles magazine in 2014. Drawing upon Beatrice's unpublished book proposal, Wallace provided a great deal of new information about the personal life of the Sedways. When I realized that there might be much more substance to Sedway's time in Las Vegas than I had previously thought, it was clear that a deeper dive into the primary sources was in order. Census material revealed a great deal about Sedway's early years in New York and his move to California. The Las Vegas Review Journal, Las Vegas Age, Las Vegas Morning Tribune, and the Las Vegas Sun, which began publication in May 1950, were rich sources of material about Sedway's business interests in Las Vegas between 1941 and early 1952. They were also excellent sources of his efforts to become part of the community, particularly the growing Jewish community. I also found an abundance of background material on the development of that community in the Southern Nevada Jewish Heritage Project in the special collections and archives in the Lead Library at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. The Las Vegas City Commission minutes, also available in the special collections, had many references to Sedway, particularly his requests for gaming licenses. I drew upon 24 oral histories from the Oral History Research Center in the university libraries at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and the Oral History Program at the University of Nevada, Reno. The more than 2,000 pages of memos, reports, and telephone transcripts that the FBI collected on Bugsy Siegel provided useful information about his relationship with Sedway from the time construction began on the Flamingo Hotel through Siegel's murder in June 1947. Following the shocking hit on Siegel, national newspapers produced a plethora of articles that yielded insights into Sedway's role in Las Vegas and his interactions with Siegel. Going back to the secondary sources on the history of Las Vegas in the 1940s was, as always, an essential part of researching the community's development. Introduction. In 1941, after initially investing in a downtown gambling club the previous year, gangster Benjamin Bugsy Siegel became truly interested in Las Vegas because Nevada state legislators had made off-track betting on horse races legal. This made Nevada the only state where bookies and the general public could bet on races no matter the location of the track. Siegel dispatched his longtime friend Mo Sedway to handle his stake in this potentially lucrative legal gambling operation. Sedway remained in Las Vegas until his death in January 1952. His decade in the rapidly growing community in southern Nevada marked the beginning of organized crime's influence there. When Nevada's state legislature approved a wide-open gambling bill in 1931, critics warned that gangsters from across the nation would find the opportunity irresistible, and they would establish mob-controlled casinos in Reno and Las Vegas. Legalized gambling did attract men from other states who had been involved in illegal gambling, and consequently, many of them had criminal records. Yet none were directly tied to the powerful mobs of New York, Chicago, Cleveland, or Miami. Moreover, because most of the gambling clubs and casinos established in Las Vegas in the 1930s were small, powerful underworld figures like Meyer Lansky in New York and Mo Dalitz in Cleveland did not see how legalized gambling in a community as small as Las Vegas, with a population under 8,000, would be worth either their investment or their time. Once off-track betting became legal in 1941, however, men like Lansky, Gus Greenbaum from Phoenix, and Dave Berman from Minneapolis began to take an interest in Las Vegas. Siegel, earlier than the others, saw the community's potential because he had gained control of the lucrative racewire business in Southern California and Arizona from representatives of the Chicago mob. Adding Las Vegas would enlarge his empire and his influence. Still, for several years, Siegel remained focused upon his legal and illegal business ventures in California. That is why he sent Sedway, a man who had spent much of his adult life operating in Siegel's considerable shadow, to Las Vegas. Sedway was ready for the assignment, as he loved going to the racetracks, had long been a bookie, he called himself a commission agent, had learned to manage illegal games in New York, Florida, and California, and had been a reliable and loyal supporter of his better-known boss for two decades. During Mo Sedway's 10 years in Las Vegas, he gained the reputation of being the man who could turn around struggling casinos and racebooks. He also led the negotiations for a syndicate of organized crime figures, including Siegel, Lansky, and Berman, in the purchase of a downtown hotel casino called the El Cortez. Working with Greenbaum, Sedway managed and remodeled the El Cortez, making it a successful and popular hotel. In just over a year, the syndicate sold the property at a profit of 27%. For a time, until he alienated the temperamental Siegel, Sedway was also involved in the construction of the Flamingo, the first Las Vegas luxury hotel along Highway 91, a road that soon became known as the Strip. After Siegel's murder in June 1947, Sedway returned to the Flamingo, where he remained on the management team until his death. He was a key player in the development of Las Vegas as a tourist center. In the dozen years following the Flamingo's casino opening in late 1946, several additional luxury hotels, Thunderbird, Desert Inn, Sahara, Sands, Royal Nevada, Riviera, Dunes, Hacienda, Tropicana, and Stardust, opened along the Strip. Most of them had been built with money provided by organized crime figures, men who saw how profitable the Flamingo had become by 1950. They came from New York, New Jersey, Illinois, Florida, Ohio, Texas, Missouri, and California. Some of the most important figures from the underworld had a stake in Las Vegas casinos. Sam Giancana, Benny Binion, Frank Costello, Willie Icepick Alderman, Joseph Doc Stacher, Dave Berman, Gus Greenbaum, Phil Castell, Johnny Roselli, Mo Dalitz, and Meyer Lansky were all involved. They were usually in the background, using frontmen to act as apparent operators of the casinos to secure licenses from state and local officials. These developments attracted a lot of attention in the national media. Between 1948 and 1951, Jack Glate and Lee Mortimer published confidential books on New York, Chicago, and Washington that focused upon scandal, vice, and the alleged links between government officials and organized crime. The last in this series was USA Confidential, and in it they contended, "The Mafia controls all of Las Vegas." For more than three decades, from the early 1950s, a host of journalists and authors described Las Vegas in similar ways. For them, organized crime was the driving force in the gambling center, and they described the impact of the underworld on Las Vegas in most hyperbolic terms. In his 1958 expose on Las Vegas titled "The Great Las Vegas Fraud," Sid Meier's argues that the city's fantastic gambling structure is controlled by hoodlums and racketeers. 5 years later, Ed Reed, investigative reporter with the Las Vegas Sun, and Ovid Damaris, who wrote several books on organized crime, co-authored the most influential book on the mob's connection to Las Vegas, The Green Felt Jungle. In their book, which remained on the New York Times bestseller list for more than 20 weeks, Reed and Damaris wrote, "There is no question about it. The town belongs to the mob." Moreover, they claimed these underworld figures were protected by a goon squad of psychopaths whose greatest pleasure in life is the torture of their fellow human beings. Las Vegas Sun columnist Ralph Pearl characterized the Greenfelt Jungle as a rehash of weary, oft-told old wives' tales about the baddies lurking in the shadows all over Las Vegas. And the paper's publisher, Hank Greenspun, fired Reed. Despite their shortcomings, the Greenfelt Jungle and the Great Las Vegas Fraud reflect the findings of investigations by the federal government into organized crime. In 1950, Tennessee Senator Estes Kefauver led the most notable of these investigations. The Special Committee on Organized Crime and Interstate Commerce drew upon testimony from more than 800 witnesses during 90 days of hearings. The outcome was 11,000 pages of data. In addition to the Kefauver Committee report on organized crime, the senator published his own book, Crime in America, and wrote a four-part series for the Saturday Evening Post, all in 1951. In Kefauver's judgment, the hearings had demonstrated that two syndicates, the Costello-dominated Combination on the East Coast and the Capone Syndicate in Chicago, had spread their influence across the country, including into the state of Nevada, where Reno and Las Vegas had emerged as the headquarters for some of the nation's worst mobsters. Later in the decade, Senator John McClellan, who chaired the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, led an even more comprehensive effort. One focused upon organized crime's ties to the powerful International Brotherhood of Teamsters. After hearings that featured more than 1,500 witnesses that led to almost twice as many pages of evidence as the Kefauver Committee's work, McClellan reached fundamentally the same conclusion as Senator Kefauver. America, McClellan believed, faced a close-knit, clandestine criminal syndicate that drew upon narcotics, vice, and gambling to finance its evil. Other probes into the connection between the underworld and Las Vegas followed over the years. Robert Kennedy, the chief counsel for the McClellan Committee, took aim at Las Vegas once he became his brother Jack's attorney general in 1961. Ronald Goldfarb, who served in the organized crime and racketeering section in Kennedy's Justice Department, explained that his boss was determined to penetrate the mob's huge financial bonanza, the Las Vegas casinos. If gambling was the multi-billion-dollar bank for organized crime, Las Vegas must have been its Federal Reserve. In 1966, Sandy Smith, a Chicago Sun-Times crime reporter, drew upon documents that the Justice Department had leaked to him about the money skimmed in Las Vegas casino count rooms. He described how some of the most important casinos along the Strip and downtown distributed millions of dollars through couriers who delivered the money to crime syndicate gangsters around the country. Between 1975 and 1986, more stories surfaced about skimming and the control the Chicago and Kansas City mobs had over several Las Vegas casinos. By 1986, aggressive investigations by federal and state officials led to indictments and convictions of more than a dozen major organized crime figures, including Chicago bosses Joseph Ioppa and Jackie Cerrone, Milwaukee gangster Frank Balestrieri, Kansas City mobsters Carl and Nick Civella and Carl DeLuna, and Teamsters president Roy Williams. Even though these prosecutions essentially broke the long hold that organized crime had on many of the hotels and casinos in Las Vegas, the image of a mob Vegas remained, primarily because of depictions of the gangsters in Las Vegas in movies and television programs well into the 21st century. Films like Las Vegas Shakedown, 1955, The Godfather, 1972, Pritzi's Honor, 1985, Bugsy, 1991, Casino, 1995, and The Cooler, 2003, and television series such as Vegas, 1978 through 1981, Crime Story, 1986 through 1988, and CSI Crime Scene Investigation, 2000 through 2015, collectively portrayed Las Vegas as a place of syndicates, crime bosses, made men, fronts, and casino skims. The generation of underworld figures who initiated the lasting link between Las Vegas and organized crime have long attracted the attention of authors. There have been biographies of Meyer Lansky, Frank Costello, Moe Dalitz, Dave Berman, and Benny Binion. Some of the first generation of gangster entrepreneurs also appeared in edited collections of biographical essays. Moe's segue is largely omitted in the catalog of work done on Las Vegas gangsters in the immediate post-war years. Occasionally, an author includes some minor references to him, but those are usually not flattering. In a book about her powerful gangster father, Dave, Susan Berman included an undated FBI characterization of Sedway. It is a document that describes him as a man with no physical power, an obvious reference to the fact that Moe was only 5'2" tall. Consequently, the agent writing the description of Sedway reported, "During periods of stress, he wrings his hands, becomes wild-eyed, and resembles a small dog about to be subjected to the distasteful procedure of being bathed." In his biography of gangster Jimmy Fratiano, author Ovid Damaris describes Sedway as a gangster no one in the underworld needed to fear. The diminutive Sedway had been a gopher for Siegel in the old days, but had become a trusted watchdog for Meyer Lansky, reporting on the business at the newly opened Flamingo Hotel in Las Vegas. According to Damaris, California gangster Jack Dragna wanted to make a move against Meyer Lansky and send Fratiano to rough up Lansky's man in the gambling center. According to Damaris, Fratiano grabbed Sedway as he left the hotel in Los Angeles and said, "Moe, I want to tell you something, you motherfucker. You better walk straight around Vegas, because next time, I'm going to blow your fucking head off." Fratiano then slapped Sedway in the face. As he tasted the blood flowing from his mouth, Sedway began crying and imploring Fratiano to leave me alone. Whether or not this really happened, the vivid image is telling. Sedway was a minor figure, easily intimidated. As the books and articles about organized crime in the 1930s and 1940s describe him, Sedway was a pathetic man of little consequence. He was just Little Moe. Sedway's absence in most of the accounts of Las Vegas casino development in the 1940s fundamentally is a consequence of his working in the shadow of Bugsy Siegel, who not only was widely known at the time, but also remains, along with Al Capone, one of the best remembered of 20th century gangsters. Indeed, documentary filmmakers, journalists, novelists, scholars, biographers, and screenwriters have produced a vast body of work on the charismatic Siegel and his connection to Las Vegas. They present him as a handsome visionary founder of the Las Vegas Strip, or as a menacing, even vicious murderer who took over the Flamingo Project from someone else, or as both. Yet Sedway was critical to Siegel's success in gaining control of the Racewire service in Las Vegas, and in securing a significant share of racebook profits. In providing a full account of his life, it is important to demonstrate that men like Sedway with suspect backgrounds, and he was one of the first, seized the opportunity to operate their enterprises in a state and city where gambling was legal. They hoped that they could shed the tarnish of their gangster pasts and become legitimate citizens. Sedway gained that recognition, not just in the obituaries published when he died in early 1952, but also in Las Vegas newspapers in the 1940s. One columnist frequently referred to Sedway as the Little Giant of Fremont Street, because the diminutive Sedway played such a major role, not only with downtown casinos in Las Vegas, but also with several philanthropic initiatives in the community and by becoming active in the political life of the community. While focused upon Moe Sedway, the chapters that follow also deal with the remarkable changes in Las Vegas in the 1940s and early 1950s that enabled the city to emerge as one of the nation's most popular tourist destinations. In the first chapter, Bugsy's Emerging Shadow in New York and California, I describe Sedway's early years in New York and include a parallel narrative of Ben Siegel as a significant player in the New York mob, headed by Charles Lucky Luciano, Meyer Lansky, and Frank Costello. Sedway, although financially successful because of his affiliation with these men, remained on the periphery of this powerful mob. He moved to Southern California in 1938 to join Siegel, who had preceded him by a few years and had prospered from illegal gaming in California and legal gaming in Mexico. Gaining control of the Racewire service in Southern California was the most important of Siegel's endeavors, and Sedway became familiar with the wire service as a successful bookie. I also describe Sedway's courtship of and marriage to Beatrice Kittle, a woman who enjoyed being part of the mob culture in New York, a culture she discussed in documentaries made several decades later. In Chapter 2, The Emergence of Las Vegas as a Gambling Town, 1905 through 1941, I describe how Las Vegas became nationally known through its acceptance of vice, alcohol, prostitution, and gambling, and the rapid development of a gambling fraternity in the town. In addition to the few men who had run small gambling operations in Las Vegas from its earliest years, two important cohorts of gambling entrepreneurs arrived between 1929 and 1941. The first group came from the copper mining town of Ely, Nevada, but the more important group came from Southern California following the 1938 election of reformer Fletcher Bowron to the mayor's office in Los Angeles and Attorney General Earl Warren's campaign to shut down gambling ships. Led by Guy McAfee, these vice lords brought their expertise in running large illegal gambling operations to Las Vegas. More important for Moe Sedway, Bugsy Siegel made his first investment in a Las Vegas casino, and the following year he dispatched Sedway to gain control of the Racewire service in Las Vegas. I also describe how the Chamber of Commerce and other civic promoters diligently sold their community to potential tourists as the last frontier town. In Chapter 3, Siegel extends his shadow to Las Vegas, 1941 through 1946. I explain how Moe Sedway was able to gain control of the Racewire service in Las Vegas with the substantial backing of his tough-minded boss, Bugsy Siegel. Sedway's skill in managing the wire service and racebooks led to his control, along with Phoenix gambler Gus Greenbaum, of the Las Vegas Club, the SS Rex Club, and the Frontier Club. Sedway also led a consortium of men, including Siegel and Lansky, in the purchase of the El Cortez Hotel in 1945, giving the New York mob its first direct stake in Las Vegas hotels. I also discussed the legitimate hotel men who entered the Las Vegas market, including Thomas Hull and William Moore. In Chapter 4, Siegel and Sedway and the fabulous Flamingo Hotel and Casino, 1946 through 1947, I make it clear that Billy Wilkerson, the successful owner of the Hollywood Reporter and Southern California nightclubs, had the inspiration for the Flamingo. He envisioned a fashionable resort hotel that would attract Hollywood celebrities and wealthy gamblers. However, he did not have experience running casinos, so he contacted Moe Sedway and Gus Greenbaum to handle that challenge. Wilkerson ultimately had to turn to organized crime figures to finance the construction of the property. In spring 1946, Bugsy Siegel seized control of the project, completing the construction of the casino in December of that year, and the hotel the following March. Because the FBI was following all of Siegel's moves, there are numerous informants' reports and transcripts of bugged telephone calls that detail Moe Sedway's role in the construction of the Flamingo. In Chapter 5, The Murder of Bugsy Siegel, June 20, 1947, I describe Siegel's murder in Beverly Hills, California, a crime that attracted press attention across the nation because he had become someone most Americans could immediately associate with organized crime. No one has ever been arrested and charged with Siegel's murder, which has led to numerous theories about who made the hit on him. From New York mob bosses who ordered it because Siegel was not making money on their investment in the Flamingo, to competitors for control of the wire service, the theories have proliferated over time. In 2014, the Sedway family revealed that Moe's widow Beatrice had written an unpublished memoir in which she claimed that her husband had ordered the hit, with Meyer Lansky's blessing, because Siegel planned to eliminate Sedway. In this chapter, I discuss all these theories with a focus upon the Sedway angle. For example, Clinton Anderson, who was the Beverly Hills police chief at the time, believed that Sedway knew who had killed Siegel. In 1947, a Las Vegas police officer told FBI agents that he believed that Sedway was involved. Ironically, Moe Sedway became a valued FBI informant at this time. Indeed, one local agent contended that Sedway was the most reliable of their Las Vegas informants. In Chapter 6, Moe Sedway emerges from Bugsy's shadow, 1947 through 1952. I describe how in the summer of 1947, Moe Sedway led the negotiations for sale of the Flamingo to new owners, a deal that permitted him to continue as one of the managers of the hotel, which began to turn a significant profit, while...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?